Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it is 3:16 p.m. That is Central Time. Today is February 3rd, and today being Friday, it's the big picture, long term audio and video for the various different asset classes. So I thought I'd kick off and think about growth, and then let's think about how does that happen. Well, there's two different ways that you can achieve growth. Well, the first thing is you come up with a brand new idea, and it blows everything else out of the water that's ever existed before, and then you capture market share like no one ever expected, and the valuation of your company goes through the roof. And we had that with the invention of the internet, and that was something that was a really phenomenal change in how the entire world did business, and disintermediation delivered exactly what it said it would, which means that it cut out all the middlemen. And that was basically a gift for a company like Amazon, where it was able to disintermediate all the mom-and-pop stores and lots of other businesses in between. And then we also had, but then we have another way of achieving growth, and that's regulation. And that's certainly something that happens, is that regulations change, and some companies will be discomfited, and then others will have the world handed to them on a plate. So Tesla is one of those types of companies, and they came up with a new way of packaging together the existing lithium-ion batteries. So that wasn't really new technology. And they certainly put it into a car that looked attractive. That was the first time anyone had done that. And then they decided they were going to build those battery packs at scale, which was an economy of scale way of achieving growth. But Tesla wouldn't have existed were it not for regulatory changes, because the thing that kept it going at the beginning were regulatory changes that meant that basically its competitors had to fund its construction, that major automotive companies like Ford and GM, they had to pay carbon credits, and then Tesla got to sell them. And that allowed them to basically fund their growth with other companies' profits. So obviously this is a key regulatory change that allowed for the growth of the company. And I think another good example of how regulatory changes then created new markets, we can go back and think about the GATT changes to agriculture. So one of the things that they did was they removed subsidies for the production of sugar in the EU and in North America. So that basically gutted the sugar production of all of Europe and all of North America. Then what happened was all that production moved to Brazil. And since that event happened in the early 2000s, the price of sugar has never fallen below 10, whereas there was a good long period prior to that where prices had been varying both above and below 10. So that was a key regulatory change that handed a massive benefit to Brazil. So that was a regulatory change in terms of growth. Then, of course, there's the whole question of interest rates. So let's think about that. When we start to think about the benefits that come from progressively lower costs of borrowing, well, we were in this phenomenally lengthy period where bond yields only came down. And it's a 40-year bull market in bonds. And the downtrend in yields has very clearly now been broken. And we're miles above the thousand day or 5 year moving average. So there's ample potential that the yield could halve and still be in the region of the 5 year moving average. And even that would still not question that the downtrend has in fact been broken. But it is worth considering that the entire period of time where we've had this huge move in technology, where we've had the invention and proliferation of the internet, the availability of the credit necessary to go out and build mobile phone networks and then expand upon them, then to build fiber optic networks, then to build all of the back end and then the front end of the social media programs and all of those data centers and all of that programming capacity, and then the invention of cloud computing and all of the data centers and programming that go into that. Well, a lot of it has been funded with cheap credit. Then, of course, we've had lots of businesses that failed in between. And that's all part and parcel of capitalism, that the businesses that can eventually generate profits survive, those that fail to garner the support necessary to keep going, then they eventually fail. So it certainly helps. If you want technology and growth, then you need interest rates that are not challenging and hopefully go down over time. You need regulatory changes very much on your side. And then it really helps if you've got a good idea. So we've had lots of that for the last 40 years. But the question, of course, is, are we going to continue to have that going forward? Well, the regulatory changes part of it is, I think, certainly going through a period of flux. So Google is one of these companies that did have some really good ideas. And they basically not only invented the search engine, but and perfected the search engine, but then they also perfected and invented a new way of targeting advertising and also for charging for advertising. And then they were able to do that in an environment where interest rates are going down and there was no regulation at all. Whereas what we've seen over the last couple of weeks is that the Department of Justice is opening an antitrust case against Google. And if for no other reason than political score grabbing and to try and highlight to disgruntled voters that something is being done about the rampant attack on information that is coming through on the internet. And obviously, some people think that there's not enough information, others think that there's too much. More people are worried about the efficacy of what they find online. And then, of course, everybody is worried now about artificial intelligence and what role that will play. I think the one thing that lots of the commentary is talking about is how artificial intelligence is going to impede the creative process and what it's going to mean for lots of people who are in the creative industry. And I think for the most talented people, it will probably enhance their productivity. For the people that are at the other end of the spectrum that are just about getting by, then that and the particularly those that rely on an iterative process, they're probably going to have the greatest difficulty. But the thing that's not being discussed at all is how wonderful artificial intelligence will be in spreading disinformation and coming up with competing narratives. So, we're definitely in a period where the false narrative is going to become progressively more convincing. And it is increasingly easy to create video that is a deep fake. And it is increasingly easy to create content that is either sang, written, performed, as if it were done by somebody else. So the disinformation that is going to arise as a result of artificial intelligence is probably going to outweigh the actual information that people get from it. And that is only going to enhance the threat that regulation burden is going to increase. So Google did rally over the last 3 or 4 months, and certainly lots of shares bottomed or put in a low in October, and we've had reversions to the mean. So this is now the first area of potential resistance. If we think about the growthy way of thinking, then interest rates are not on side. The regulatory change is not on side. And then the question, of course, is will the big ideas be able to compensate for all those things? Or does the big idea that comes forward have to gel with the other two factors? I think that's the most important question right now. Then I think it's important to think about Tesla in those perspectives, because the regulatory environment is certainly still in Tesla's favor, but it's in everyone else's favor now too. And what was interesting, I think, was Ford in here today. They announced that they didn't sell as many vehicles as they were anticipating, and that they're still having trouble with the supply chain. But of course, what it also suggests is interest rates have gone up a lot, and companies are spending a great deal of money on trying to migrate into a regulatory environment that is favorable. So that's basically what the automotive sector is doing. They are sick of funding Tesla's growth, and they want to participate in the electric vehicle sector as well, because they're not capable of surviving outside of the regulatory environment. But of course, that also means that they need access to money, and interest rates are rising, and the 10-year yield is still hovering here around 3.5%, and bounced again in here this week from the region of the 200-day moving average. And I think we have to just pay some due consideration to the fact that this is a consistent uptrend, where we have a series of ranges, one above the last, and each of the ranges is in the region of about 75 basis points. So, and I think we could just say that this is somewhere around the 320 or 325 area. That's about 70 basis points. And this one is also about the same. So, as long as we're seeing ranges one above another, then we have to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. I continue to think, though, that eventually we're going to start to see the impact of quantitative tightening. And the size of the Fed's balance sheet has contracted by just over 500 billion in the space of about 6 months. And even though the ECB said that they're not going to start their quantitative tightening program until this month, they've shaved €1 trillion off the size of their balance sheet. Now, I think it's worth highlighting the role that the dollar plays in global liquidity, because it is the reserve currency. And the dollar pulled back in really quite a dynamic manner over the last 2 months. So that has certainly created demand for non-US assets. It has stoked interest in the precious metals, and it has fueled a rebound in speculative activity. And when we look at the primary central bank balance sheets, redenominate them into dollars, even though the dollar was going down, or because the dollar was going down, then what we've basically seen is that we've had a good sized rebound in this measure. Now it's beginning to roll over because the dollar has started to rebound. And this, I think, brings up the another big question. But and that, of course, is about the cost of financing government debt and the question of how much of an inflationary problem do we have and how long is it going to last? And then, of course, you have the regulatory question. So, on the one hand, we have the big regulatory environment right now is about, and I'm going to try and split this recording up into three phases. First, thinking about the regulatory environment, then thinking about interest rates, and then thinking about where growth is likely to come from as a result of those two things. Carbon credits are back at the upper side of their range. And my view about these is they're almost like government bonds, but you're not getting a yield. But you are definitely getting government support. And this is an artificial construct. It's not like carbon credits would exist without regulatory changes to support them. And there's a reason why the price is high, and it's very clear. That's a government policy. They want prices higher in order to ensure the competitiveness of the renewable energy sector. And that is obviously a really significant issue for Europe because they don't want to be beholden to Russia any longer. So they're going to do whatever it takes to reduce the competitiveness of fossil fuels because they simply do not want to have to continue to import from Russia. And then we can also think about what that meant in terms of volatility. And natural gas prices went from about 25 to 300 in the space of about 18 months. And that massive move on the upside in the middle of last year, that was really about price insensitive buying. In other words, Europe was willing to spend whatever it took to ensure that they had ample supplies for this winter. And because the winter hasn't been particularly cold, then inventories are high, they're not buying anymore, and prices have come back down. And that has also meant that natural gas prices in the USA are also very weak and are back into the two handle and approaching the lows put in between in 2020 and then in 2016. And this has been a phenomenally swift crash between the third quarter of 2022 and now. The price has fallen almost 80%. And that's really quite profound. And it is purely on the back of the fact that Europe isn't buying US gas any longer, and therefore they have nowhere to sell the excess supply. And prices are coming down in a very aggressive manner. Now, ultimately, Europe is going to have to buy. And they are going to try and excise coal from their energy system in the near term. That's regardless of the fact that it is a reliable, available, domestic source of base load electricity. Europe is going to do whatever it can to get rid of it because they're continuing to raise carbon credit prices. And the alternative has to be natural gas. And then, of course, you have the bigger questions about where are we going to get the resources necessary to ensure that there will be enough of metals to replace the demand for fossil fuels. So we saw this week that General Motors was investing in Lithium Americas, giving them in excess of $600 million to go off and build the Thacker Pass mine. Now, the Thacker Pass mine hasn't quite been approved yet, and they're still going through the regulatory process, but it looks quite likely that the regulatory process will be smoothed out in order to try and get that mine built. Now, another company that is looking at trying to get the regulatory push on their side is Perpetua Resources. Now, it's regarded as a gold mine, but that's not really what they're trying to get the company permissioned through. So they're trying to reopen a manganese mine, or is it? I think it's manganese, and that's obviously a major component in battery manufacturing. Now, Boise, Idaho, is where they are headquartered, and they're trying to reopen an old mine in Idaho. And Idaho isn't exactly a mining-friendly location. Now, it's not like they don't know that the resources are there. They do. And they know it's a world-class potential mine. And the big question is whether they can get the regulatory wherewithal to get it done. Now, the regulatory environment over the last 40 years has been toward tighter and tighter regulation against mining. And that was enabled by offshoring, that the mining didn't have to happen at home because it could happen somewhere else. And as long as it happened somewhere else and out of sight, and the refined products made at home, or the products made from the refined products made at home, then nobody was really worried about it. But because we have tighter geopolitical tensions and now competition for not just sourcing material but access to material, then the regulatory environment has to change. And these types of companies, where they're trying to bring new resources online and they face many of the same kinds of regulatory obstacles that have stopped programs in the past, well, those are going to be the bellwethers for whether we can anticipate that there will be new mines built and as a result of key regulatory changes. So, on the one hand, we have the traditional technology companies that have done exceptionally well and become the largest companies in the world, like Google or Meta. And Meta has rallied really spectacularly over the course of the last 3 months and just about doubled and is now experiencing the first area of potential resistance. And I think when we think about where the regulatory environment is going, well, it's not in favor of the large social media companies. And it is progressing nicely for the mining sector. Now, there is absolutely no question that what the mining sector needs to do is spend a lot more money on hearts and minds and reaching out to investors in the Western world. Many miners do a reasonable job of trying to placate the local populations wherever they're building their mines. And they have, and many of the larger companies have done a pretty good job of building hospitals and roads and schools for the local communities and providing income by the way of jobs for them. But they do a dismal job of trying to demonstrate all of that good work for the rest of the world. Now, obviously, that's eventually going to have to change. And then, of course, the question will be whether it's even possible to achieve the growth targets of the wider market. So, copper prices came down rather aggressively this week following the strength of the dollar. Now, let's think about the contango. The price right now is in contango, but it's not a big contango. And this is, I think, important that we have a contango rather than a backwardation. When we think about the futures curve, well, we can definitely see then that we have a contango between now and the beginning of 2024, and then a backwardation subsequently. So it would suggest that there's plenty around right now and that there might be a shortage later. That's very much tied to the continued advance in production of electric vehicles from the major automotive companies. And the market isn't willing to give the benefit of the doubt to the valuations. When we think about a company like Volkswagen or GM or Ford, where we have these exceptionally low valuations and single digits, and Volkswagen trading on a PE of 5 and yielding 4.5, and rallying this week and testing the region of the 200-day moving average. A lot of bad news has been priced in, but they definitely have a transition underway to try and get back on side with regulation. And as long as they're doing that, then they should benefit that they'll be able to sell carbon credits in future. So that's obviously a significant change. Now, of course, then the question will be how will they fund their operations? So for now, they're funding the transition through their balance sheets. And of course, then the big question will be what happens to bond yields in Europe? The Bund yield is at around 2.2% right now. It was really quite volatile this week. So we had a drop yesterday and a rebound in here today. And we had a lot of talk this week from central banks. So the Federal Reserve raised interest rates by 25 basis points this week, which was less than the 50 basis points they raised the last time. And the Bank of England and the ECB both raised rates by 50 basis points. And all of them noticed or highlighted that inflationary pressures are starting to moderate. And that's obviously very welcome news. But then the big question is, are we going to have an inflationary environment like we did in the 1970s? Or was this a flash in the pan? Is this just one big new inflationary trend because of the pandemic that will quickly peter out and we'll go back to the disinflationary environment that was evident for most of the last 40 years? So let's just unpick that a little. Well, the first thing is that we stoked inflationary pressures all over the developed world by printing a ton of money. And that ton of money is only just beginning to be taken out of circulation. So that's going to take time above all other factors. There was the clear willingness of politicians to think that modern monetary theory works. And they were basically told to think that by economists, but they had an incentive to think that because bond yields were coming down and they'd been coming down for years. And then they have these liabilities that continue to rise. Now, whether that is liabilities like healthcare, and that I think is one of the biggest issues for the UK, that the cost of the NHS is continuing to climb. It's within the top 10 employers in the world and occupies about 4 to 5% of the total UK population work directly for the NHS. So then, of course, the question is, what are the ancillaries when you have 4% or 5% of the population that work directly for the NHS? How many other companies are gaining income as a result of that? And that is very clearly a massive draw on the UK economy. Then we can think about Germany. Well, Germany has had this vibrant manufacturing sector and has been the most successful exporter in Europe and done spectacularly well from supplying machines and power plants to most of the emerging markets. And they also have an aging population, and they have the big question about the EU, that Germany basically had the entire EU take their currency, and now they're stuck with them. So that means that mutualization of debt is a reality for the future, and arguably for the present, and that they're going to have to continue to print the money necessary to fund the liabilities of countries like Italy. And there's really no way of getting around that. And that is in an environment where the European population is rapidly aging. So then the productive capacity of those economies is under threat as well. Well, the USA doesn't have the same issues with government-funded healthcare, and it doesn't have the same issues with an aging population because the population is reasonably younger. But nonetheless, government spending is out of control, and the unfunded liabilities from Social Security and the retirement community, despite the fact that the US has a somewhat younger population, the promises made to the retiring baby boomers are going to put significant pressure on government finances. And the cost of servicing the debt is already at $500 trillion. And if government bond yields continue to trend higher, then it's going to create a significant budget constraint. So then, of course, we're in this environment where we have the question of what's going to happen with inflation. Well, I think that we have enough evidence. Whether one looks at the 1930s, where they tried to curtail the supply of money, and that contributed to the depression. Well, that's what they're doing now. The supply of money has contracted steadily for the last year, and now it's negative. So they're siphoning money out of the US economy, and they're reducing the size of their balance sheet, and they're raising interest rates. And so far, we have not seen any impact on employment. And because that hasn't happened yet, then investors are now willing to think that maybe interest rates will go higher. Of course, yesterday, they were willing to bet that interest rates would not go higher. So then the bigger question is, where does the inflationary issue start to come in? Do we get inflation because there's simply too much money chasing too few goods? And then we do have still got supply constraints, and those supply constraints are spotty. When we think about the retail price for a dozen eggs, well, then it's at new highs. That's at about $4.25, and in 2020 it was around 150. But then we also had this spike in lumber prices, and the price went to really quite extraordinary levels, and then came back down again, and then went back up again, and has bounced over the last 3 weeks and paused in here today in the region of the 200-day moving average. So definitely the inflation from one of the basic components of building houses is not nearly as pressing now as it was in the past. But the big question then is about consumer behavior. And one of the things that happened during the pandemic was all of this money that was printed and sent to consumers. And it resulted in a significant upgrade in the lifestyle of many people. So, when we look at revolving debt, and think about that demand for credit. Well, that demand for credit is currently around 1.18 trillion, and it's at a new high. So people were definitely chastened in 2008, and the demand for credit went down. Then it recovered steadily into 2019 and then roared back in 2021 and 2022. And as we see interest rates rising, then that is going to have an impact on how many goods are available. And the cost of holding inventory when interest rates are high becomes prohibitive. So then you're in an environment where used car prices actually started going up. So we had this huge run higher in used car prices in 2020 and 2021, and then they bounced in January because there isn't enough of inventory, and companies are in a situation where the major automotive companies don't want to send out inventory, and they want to go even more into just-in-time manufacturing. They were trying to limit supply to sustain prices, and that's contributing to their lower valuations, that they're making more money by selling fewer cars. That's going to contribute to prices staying higher for longer. And the only way it's going to stop is when people stop buying cars. Then we know that the cost of mortgages has gone up. So then we've seen that housing prices have eased back. I'm not getting, it was very amusing in 2021. That and early 2022, that I was getting these emails from realtors saying, "Owen, you're a millionaire and your house has gone up by this much, and all you have to do is sell and you can capture all this money." And of course, it never tells you where you're going to live after that. But I'm not getting those emails anymore because prices are coming down. So, with the jump in mortgage prices, or mortgage rates, then that is starting to sap demand for homes. And that also means that if people aren't buying as many homes and they're not moving as much as they were in 2020, 21, and 22, well, then they're not going to be buying as much stuff to put into those houses or to do renovation work either. So then we can think about the home builders. And Lennar has rebounded in really emphatic fashion. And it did then pause in here this week. So there was a real willingness to think that we're going to have this really impressive advance and that we're going to go straight back down into a very low interest rate environment indefinitely. And I just don't believe that that's rational. I think it is much more likely that we're going to get a deflationary shock, and that will eventually bring yields down. But that the uptrend in the total performance of, or the total return of bonds has been broken. So I'm long bonds right now. And I'm willing to hold on to them because I think there will be a deflationary shock and bonds will prosper in that environment. And the relative performance of those eight large FANG companies has rebounded exceptionally impressively this month, and it is now right in the region of the 200-day moving average and the lower side of that overhead top formation. So, having had the big reversionary rally, then it is likely that we're going to see some at least pause in consolidation, but potentially that this is about as high as they're going to go, and that we move into a much lengthier period of consolidation. And that is purely on the back of interest rates. Now, we know that the cost of servicing debts is rising along with yields. And if yields stay high, then governments are really in a tight position, because it's very hard to raise taxes from where they are already. This is, I think, graphically illustrated in the UK, because the tax burden is already high, and there's lots of people want to blame everybody else for the problem. So the Bank of England is in a difficult position. They have no choice. They have to talk the market down, and they're laying the blame at everybody's feet. Young people aren't working enough. The people are retiring too early, and corporations aren't hiring enough, and immigration policy is wrong-footed. We don't have enough workers. And then you have the fact that some people aren't getting taxed enough, and that labor unions aren't getting enough of, or aren't being patriotic enough. So it's everybody's fault. And or at least everyone else thinks it's everyone else's fault. But the reality is that the UK now is an energy importer, and it used to be an energy exporter. And the expansion of the NHS was funded by reducing spending on defence. And those two factors are what really allowed the NHS to grow as such a large part of the economy, funded by the change in regulation. And that was a really profound change, that we've had this easy environment for the working people, that and it was part of the social contract that you work, and in return you will be looked after in your retirement and you'll have free healthcare. But that was on the assumption that there would be an ever-increasing number of people coming into the workforce, and that is just not the case. And now we're in a situation where there is a keen need to get inflation under control in a hurry in order to rebalance government finances. And this is also going to be particularly true for the USA. And it's going to be true for countries like Italy, where government finances have never been okay. And it's going to be an issue for Japan as they try to think about, now that they have inflation, what are they going to do about it? And it's going to be an issue for China because their growth has been funded by debt for the last decade, and leverage ratios are at extraordinary levels. And the answer to the slowing economy has to go back to the old drawing book. So then they really do need to get inflation under control. But the way to get inflation under control will be to kill demand. And that means that the upgrade in lifestyle that many people experienced during the pandemic, where they get to work from home, work the hours they wish, get paid the same or more for doing the same amount of work, and that's probably going to end. And people are going to start feeling more pressure that if they lose their job, are they going to be able to find another job that can sustain them in their new locations? And lots of people, and I am reminded of the fact that Perpetua Resources is headquartered in Idaho, but there's a lot of people from California moved to Boise, Idaho during the pandemic, particularly those that like skiing. And there's not much in Boise, Idaho. If you can work from home, well, that's great. If you lose your job working from home, you better find somewhere that will pay you the same amount of money to do the same thing for somebody else. Well, a lot of those automotive companies have been hiring the engineers fired by the tech companies. And that's a good thing. It means that they'll be in a better position to compete with companies like Tesla. But when we get a crash like we saw with ARK Innovation's ETF, and they still hold many of the same types of companies, well, the price came down from 160 to 40. Well, it came down to 30. And then we get this good-sized rally, and it looks like a failed downside break. And it could even go to 60. But after having a massive surge and an even more impressive crash, the likelihood is that we go into a type 3 base formation. So, and of course, then the question for these companies is, can they survive in a higher interest rate environment overall? The one thing that I think is important to highlight is that the yield curve spread, it's really negative. And that's only half of the question. That basically implies there's going to be a recession. But the bigger point here is that the peak was lower. In the last 30 years, every time the yield curve went from inverted to positive, it peaked out around 275 basis points. So there was a really wide interest rate differential between the long and the short end of the curve, and that helped to recapitalize the banking sector, refund credit. And then in 2020 and 21, it got up to about 150 basis points and then collapsed. So this is basically suggesting that what we're going to have are shorter cycles. And in order to forestall inflationary pressures, government or central banks aren't going to be in a position to take interest rates all the way down to zero. So not only have lifestyles been upgraded, but the visceral experience of having to deal with double-digit inflation for central banks means that they're just not going to be in a position to take that risk in future. So when we do get a recession, they will cut interest rates, but they're unlikely to cut them as deep as they have in the past. And then they're more likely to keep them higher for longer and to start raising them again after a shorter interval. Now, what that suggests is we're going to have a very choppy environment for the growth sector of the economy. The kinds of companies that rely on access to cheap liquidity, then they're not going to have it indefinitely. Now, we can then think about the high yield bond market. So it reverted to the 200-day moving average, and then we had this quite clear fail to sustain the breakout in here today. It popped on the upside yesterday, and it came straight back down again in here today. One of the factors that has been held out as An example of why we should not expect a recession is that high yield spreads have been contracting. And with the move that we had in the high yield market today, then I think it is quite likely that this spread is going to start going up again next week. And the issue with the high yield spread is that it can move fast. So one really does have to anticipate what's going to happen next. So if it fails to sustain this move below the 200-day moving average, then we have to assume that we're going to have a pop on the upside. And major lows don't occur until high yield spreads are somewhere north of 800 basis points. And then there are rare occasions when they get significantly higher than that. Now, one of the, I think that it is worth highlighting here that if we look just at the news for Citrix Systems, so Goldman Sachs is looking at giving them a loan on an interest rate of 14%. So, that's a lot. And when we think about interest rates, that's a spread of 10%. Now, when we think about some of these loans, and I will go into one of these loans just so that we can look at what the rating is. So we're not talking about the highest level of the high yield sector. This is a B as opposed to a BBB rated. But one thing that was also highlighted by traders is that the spread between the CCC and B ratings was down to about 400 basis points. Well, if you add 400 basis points to 400 basis points, and then add that to 4% yields, you get 12. So that's where yields are for CCC rated bonds right now, about 12%. And when you've got a 12% yield, then investors start to get interested because a spread of 8% when interest rates are at close to zero, that's a lot. Now you're only getting a spread, a pickup of about 400 basis points on the worst rating bonds versus just merely bad rated bonds. But even then, the major lows in the market occur when these are at exceptionally wide levels. And it is worth highlighting that the peaks were about equal to one another in 2009 and in 2000. And we've had squalls in the market since then. So I think that we have to be prepared for the potential that it's going to look something like this, that we're going to see a higher reaction low start to come in here, and that subsequently the spread is going to march higher from here. So then, if we think then about the inflationary issues, central banks are presented with a stark choice. They either kill inflation now and it really does become transitory, or they, and of course what that means is that we have to go through a recession. We have to see a re-rating of lifestyles, re-ratings of demands, reimposition of delayed gratification, and people simply waiting to buy things and thinking that their life is going to be fine without it. Because one of the definite effects of the pandemic was to tell people that you could die tomorrow, so there's no point waiting. And the willingness of the stock market and for of investors to believe that we're going back to the pre-pandemic era, where we're going to have low interest rates and a really aggressive, speculative environment is certainly something that helped to stoke investment demand. And then I think we have to think about the private equity sector. So, private equity did fantastically well because we had this change in regulation with carried interest. Then we had exceptionally low interest rates. And what they did was they put their money into unloved assets that were reasonably cheap but illiquid, and were able to hold on for longer to allow the pace of the advance to progress. So when we think about what that means, well, there is, I think, this interesting environment right now. And when I look at what the kinds of things that come into my inbox. So I got an invite to this alternative assets conference in Los Angeles in March. And let me see if I can find it here. So this conference, and they initially told me that it would be free, and now they are telling me that they want $1,500. But then let's just think about who the speakers are going to be. And this is going to be a really a star-studded event. So they're going to have former vice presidents of the USA, and then they're going to have Cathie Wood, local Los Angeles girl, and going to have people from all over California that have been investing in private assets. And these are, I think this is going to be a very interesting conference. I'm still deciding whether I want to spend the $1,500 to go to it or not. But we've definitely had a significant setback for the sector. So Blackstone saw that the withdrawals from its institutional REIT hit their limits again this week. So they are willing to, I think it's let go about 5 billion a month or 5 billion a year. I can't remember which is which. And the trend is still down. It has not broken the sequence of lower rally highs. And Brookfield has just gone through a demerger, and they've been deploying these types of regulatory loophole to avoid or to create degrees of separation between various parts of the business and themselves. So that's also testing the sequence of lower rally highs, and was in negative territory in here today. These types of companies are very clearly investing in the or on the assumption that regulatory environments are never going to change. Interest rates will be low for an indefinite period, and they will have no imposition, that they'll be able to buy whatever they want indefinitely, everywhere. And I think that will be challenged. That I saw somebody from Apollo saying that the outsized returns for the sector have been available for the last 40 years, and that's not going to change. But that is 100% on the assumption that interest rates stay down indefinitely. And the total return on bonds is now trending down. and it was the most consistent trend in the world for 40 years. So it's implying that the bull market in debt has ended, and that we're now in more of a trader's environment. So I think that's certainly something to bear in mind, that if this is the limit of how much of a rally we're going to see, then there's obviously the potential here that the Federal Reserve is going to continue to hold rates higher for as long as it takes to kill inflation, and that they are more likely than not to break something and then end up with higher unemployment. And subsequently, they will cut rates and then not hold them down for a prolonged period. So I think we're going to move into a much more volatile period. We've had ample examples of that in January of 2023, where we had this storming rally, and it got everybody thinking that they've missed the boat. Well, we're going to find out next week just how much of these gains can be held, because we're at the first area of potential resistance for a large number. Now let's think about where is the regulatory environment going to support, and what are the sectors that should do well? Well, I think that when we think about the newest iteration of Allegheny, so we've had this very clear breakout from a well-defined base formation, and they produce specialized steel. And when we think about their suppliers, well, or sorry, the companies they sell to, it's defense companies. So basically, they're producing steel that goes into stuff that's going to get blown up. And when we're in a geopolitically tense environment, then we're going to see more spending on arms. So BAE Systems had popped on the upside in the latter part of last year and then is consolidating right now. But it's indefinite, or I guess it's inevitable, that there's going to be additional spending. And this is most particularly true for countries like Germany, where they've been neglecting spending on arms for a really prolonged period. So Rheinmetall is still pausing here in the region of its all-time peaks, but it has got a long runway of orders that are in its future. So I think the defense sector is a no-brainer. And then the energy sector. Well, we're in a very interesting environment right now because oil prices are under pressure. And I think that we're likely to see oil coming down. I think that higher interest rates and the threat of a global recession are going to put downward pressure on oil prices. And it's going to question the resolve of the US government, because the Biden administration has been, I think, lukewarm, or I think more accurately, wishy-washy on supporting the energy sector. On the one hand, telling the energy sector that if they produce, it'll get bought, and on the other, castigating the energy sector for giving or for announcing bigger buybacks. So, West Texas Intermediate was down $2.50 today, and it reversed an earlier advance. And the US government has said in plain English they're going to be buying for the strategic reserve between $67.50 and $72.50. So we're within a dollar of the upper bound of that band. And I think the market is going to test their resolve, because the US government has already hit the budget ceiling, or the ceiling on the debt. Where's the money going to come from to buy back for the strategic reserve? And I think that is something that's going to get tested by the market. And it suggests that energy prices could easily come down from here. And that will also contribute to deflationary forces. Now, some of the wage demand growth is also starting to moderate. And we have positive real wages in the USA at present, and that's not going to last either. And when unemployment starts to rise, those wage increases are going to evaporate. So, at the same time, the OPEC is not increasing supply. They want to see higher prices for longer. And the big energy companies are not boosting supply because they don't want to have to deal with the ESG movement. But at the same time, these forecasts for a zero carbon global economy are absolutely fanciful. So we're going to be in an environment where we're going to be using oil for the lengthy medium term. And the biggest threat will be on coal demand. And it's going to be a long time before we stop using oil. So there's the strong likelihood then that oil prices will rebound as soon as interest rates start to come back down. But they'll probably go down first. And that will create buying opportunities. So, when we think about the energy sector and how well it has done for 2 years in a row, it was the best performing asset class between 2021 and 2022. And the energy spider is right in the region of its peak from back in 2008 and 2014. And it's losing momentum. And likely to come back down and test the 200-day moving average next week, and it could potentially break lower. So I don't think this is the time to be overweight in energy. I think instead it's more likely that we're going to see some selling pressure here. And then let's think about the industrial resources. So a higher dollar puts quite a bit of pressure on at the industrial resources sector. But the industrial metal miners are rallying back up to the upper side of their range. The FTSE 100 in the UK this week hit a new all-time high, at least on a closing basis. Now, let's just look at who the best performers were in here today. So Shell was the fourth best, and then we had BAE Systems. But it was other companies were particularly in the healthcare sector and in the consumer sector were leading the advance. And then in the domestic retail sector as well. So JD Sports and Fashion has surged higher over the course of the last 3 weeks. And that is against a background where the Bank of England is talking about the UK being in a recession. And this is a fashion, or I guess a sports fashion retailer. And this is obviously telling us that there's still plenty of money floating around. So we're still in an environment where there's a lot of liquidity floating around. And there's a lot of money on the sidelines that was ready to jump in and speculate at the beginning of the year. And that tells us that financial conditions are still really quite accommodative. So, this is, I think, something that we need to bear in mind, that with unemployment still very low, then financial conditions are really starting to become much more accommodative. And that is only going to strengthen the resolve of central banks to continue to raise rates. That is despite the fact that the Federal Reserve didn't mention them at all in the press conference this week. In an environment where inflation is still high, getting better, but still high, they're in no hurry to cut interest rates. And that suggests that the risk of an accident is going to increase. The basis for the continued rebound and enthusiasm that we're going to have a soft landing is rooted in the expectation that they'll cut interest rates quickly. But if they don't cut interest rates quickly, then that increases the risk of an accident. And then you get a deflationary shock, which overtakes market expectations. So I think that the risk here is that we do get another pause in consolidation in asset prices. And high yield spreads are far and away the thing to pay attention to. If high yield spreads start to march higher from here, then that is going to be a further indication that we should be prepared for lower prices overall. So when I think about the longer term, ultimately, the bigger question isn't so much about whether emerging markets are going to perform. I think it is more a point of when. So Adani Enterprises has collapsed over the last week, and the value of the share has halved in January. And the Nifty index was in positive territory in here today. And then, obviously, if the dollar continues to extend its rally, I don't believe that that's going to last indefinitely. So it would suggest then that what we're going to see is a pause in consolidation within the emerging markets. And that will then open up the next buying opportunity. The epicenter of risk in this market is the private equity sector because it has corrected least. It is where leverage is most focused, and it is intrinsically tied to interest rates coming down indefinitely. And private equity is not really a factor in the emerging markets, so they have a significant degree of separation. And that is also where population growth, improving standards of governance, and the potential for earnings to improve are focused. So this could easily be the decade of emerging markets. It would then help to sustain demand for commodities. Gold prices have pulled back exceptionally violently for 2 days. We had a downside key day reversal yesterday, downside follow through in here today. That translated into a downside weekly key reversal. So that's a peak of at least near-term significance. And it suggests that there is ample scope for the dollar to rebound in a really aggressive manner for the next month or two. And the dollar is also now finding support against the yen, and it's at the upper side of the range and testing the region of the lows from back in 2015, or the upper side, or excuse me, the highs from 2015. So there's certainly the potential here that we're going to see significant dollar strength. And that will then also act as a contraction in global liquidity. So definitely the risks are skewed towards a compression in asset prices, which will then set up attractive buying opportunities. And I think with that, I'll leave you for the weekend, and I wish all the best to all of you.